Sorry to interrupt your meal, but I'd like to get this started soon. Hi, I'm Nanhi In, a board of governor at the FCC and a freelance journalist. Firstly, can I ask everyone to silence your phones or switch them off, please? Also, some upcoming events at the FCC this month. We've got Chandran Nair to talk about the latest edition of the book, The Other 100 Entrepreneurs, which looks at everyday entrepreneurs who drive the world economy. On May 11th, we've got prison chaplain Tobias Bradner, who will shed light on life in Hong Kong prisons. Now on to our topic today, which also warrants serious attention, human trafficking and slavery. Matt Friedman is a very vocal activist against the smuggling and trade of people. Our speaker will share some more accurate statistics about the realities of trafficking and slavery, but apparently every 5 seconds a person enters slavery. Friedman will share a comprehensive update on modern human slavery in this region. He will also share the role the private sector plays, as well as what is needed to combat the issue. He has over 25 years of experience in battling modern-day slavery in the region. Previously, he was with the UN's Interagency Project on Human Trafficking in Thailand. Currently, Friedman is the CEO of the Mekong Club, an organization that addresses human trafficking by fighting the business of slavery with the involvement of Hong Kong-based business leaders to counter human trafficking. Let's hear what he has to say. Everyone, please give a warm welcome to Matt Friedman.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to be here today. As you see on the screen, it talks about both human trafficking and slavery, and hopefully by the end of this talk, you'll have a better sense of why I have those two together. How many of you have seen me speak before? Okay, my apologies, I'll be repeating some things, just so you know. I wasn't gonna say some things, but after our discussion here, I feel like I'm gonna say it anyways. So let me begin by talking about human trafficking first. When most people think about human trafficking, this is what they think about: forced prostitution. And for good reason. There's 4.5 million women and girls in forced prostitution situations around the world. My first exposure to this was many, many years ago when I was living and working in Nepal. I was a young public health officer, and I was coming in contact with a lot of HIV-positive girls that were 12, 13, 14 years old. Didn't know what was going on. Initially thought, well, maybe what we have here is a situation of transfusions that are going wrong. So we went and we actually talked to these young women and came to hear the same story over and over again, how they were tricked and deceived into a situation where they ended up in the brothels in Mumbai. Now, as we went and kind of got into the stories, we came to realize that, for the most part, a lot of the stories were very much the same. It often went like this. Trafficker, guy around 25 years old, would go into a village, flash a bunch of money around, basically say he was looking for a wife. He didn't want an urban wife, he wanted a rural wife. And so he'd look around until he found somebody, eventually befriend that person, and then actually 2 days later be married to that individual. Now, the family thought, wow, this is great. My daughter has a handsome husband. He has money. He's going to take care of her and us. Everyone's happy. He then goes and says, okay, well, I need to take her to Kathmandu, but don't worry, I'll be back in 3 months. But instead of going to Kathmandu, he takes her down to Mumbai, India. Takes her to the red light district. She's looking around, kind of wondering what's happening. Finally, he says, okay, well, just stay here. Everything's going to be fine. I'll be back in about 10 minutes. No, don't leave me. No, it's going to be fine. So he goes away, finds the madam, gets his $600 for having sold her to the brothel, gets the gold from the wedding, and then basically hands over the wedding pictures, and then goes back to Nepal to do it again and again and again. And in a year, he can do this 80 times. After that, the madam goes into the room and says to the girl, guess what? Your husband just sold you to me, and you're going to do everything I say, and you're going to be with up to 10 men a day, 7 days a week. Her initial response is, no, that's not happening here. My husband loves me. Yes, that's what happened. Well, I'll kill myself before I do that. If you hurt yourself, we'll hurt your family. Is this your mom, your dad, your sister? From the wedding photos. You hurt yourself, we're going to go and find them. So she's trapped in this situation. To make her into a prostitute, they bring in professional rapists. And these guys will come in and rape her over and over and over, maybe 30 times in a two-day period, till eventually she gets to a point where she just lays back and accepts what happens to her. She'll then be put on the line. She'll be forced to have sex with 10 men a day, 7 days a week, for 2 years, until eventually she gets to a point where, for the most part, she's used up, clients aren't paying for her anymore, she's thrown out on the street. She's lucky she gets back to Nepal. One of these girls came up to me and said, you know, I was raped 7,000 times. I said, excuse me? She said, 10 times a day for 2 years, that's over 7,000 times. And she couldn't understand why nobody came to help her. Now, for me, it wasn't until I actually went to Mumbai that I understood the sheer horror of what we're dealing with here. I was asked by the Indian government to go in and do public health checks. I was going from brothel to brothel. I would go inside, look to see if they had condoms being used. At one of the brothels, there was an 11-year-old trafficking victim. She saw me, saw an opportunity, ran up and wrapped herself around me, said, save me, they're doing terrible things to me. I looked at the girl. She was wearing a dress that was 8 or 10 sizes too big. She was desperate, she was crying. And I said, okay, we'll get you out of here. Police officer I was with said, no, you won't. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, where we are now in the middle of the red light districts, they'll kill us before they let us out. Make a long story short, we left, we came back, but of course she was gone. And I tell this story because a lot of the people who get into this space, like me, get into it because we have experiences like this. I didn't wake up one day and say, when I grow up, I want to be an activist. Quite the contrary, I did everything I could to avoid it. But eventually you get to a point where it just gets under your skin. You can't turn away and you surrender to it. But it's not just women and girls in prostitution. We also have men and boys who end up on fishing boats. You hear a lot about this in Thailand. Story here, Cambodian person, hears that there's work on a fishing boat. He's told that if he gets on the boat, that he'll go out for 3 months and make a whole bunch of money. Well, that's not what's gonna happen. Once he gets on the boat, it goes out for 4 years. He'll eat rice and fish twice a day, no fruits and vegetables. He'll work 18 hours a day. To get him to work, they give him stimulants. If he gets ill or gets injured or captain doesn't like him, they just throw him off the boat. At the end of the 4 years, he asks whether or not he can have some money. Captain says, go away. You know, you're from Cambodia. Nobody's gonna listen to you. Even if the cops come, they're gonna put you in jail, not me. That's an example of human trafficking. Sweatshops. Other situation that we see here is a person from Burma hears that there's work in seafood packing. There's a place called Sumit Sakhan. He goes down there, he knocks on the door of the wrong factory. Factory owner comes out and says, what do you want? I need a job. Okay, I'll give you a job. I'll pay you $50 US a month, but you have to stay in the factory. He's never had any kind of money like that before. Never had more than $25 a month. So he says, absolutely yes. Goes into the factory, works 16, 17 hours a day under horrific circumstances. At the end of the 2 months, goes and asks for his money. Factory owner says, well, you know, I forgot to mention it costs $54 US for you to be here. I'm only paying you $50. Basically, you owe me money. You can't leave until you pay that back. This is an example. Now, an emerging trend that we're seeing that we haven't seen before is a form of human slavery and trafficking that existed 2,000 years ago, where with ISIS, you have women being rounded up and actually chained, put into these cages, bid in certain houses to be either wives or sex slaves. We have situations where Boko Haram is basically kidnapping women and forcing them onto the workers or the soldiers that they have there. On the top right photo, you see kind of these Rohingyas that are languishing in Thailand. Just this morning there was a story on this, how there were these camps where they were brought into the camps, and they try to extort money from the families first. If they can't, then they sell the people. Oftentimes they're in horrific situations. And then the last picture is of Syria, all of these people going across from Africa to Italy on these boats, many of them not making the journey. So 5 years ago, we weren't seeing any of these types of cases. This is kind of a new trend for us, and we're not really quite sure how to address it. When it comes to child trafficking, there's approximately 5.5 million children that are in this situation. The circle has a picture of a young boy who's a child soldier. I offer this just to give you the sense of variety that exists with human trafficking. It's not just about labor. These kids are picked up from the villages. Oftentimes, they're taken away to a camp. They're trained, and their initiation is to go back and kill their parents to demonstrate their allegiance to the organization they're with. And they do that for two reasons. Basically, to demonstrate that they are monsters and that there's no place to go back to because you don't have your parents there anymore. So this is another horrific element of human trafficking. Now, when I worked for the United Nations, we had a definition. And the way the definition worked is you had three parts for adults. An act by means of, for the purpose of exploitation. So what you had here is if you had one of these and one of these for the purpose of exploitation, you had trafficking. So if you harbored a person with threats for the purpose of exploitation or recruited them with fraud for the purpose of exploitation, you had human trafficking. For children, you didn't need the second category. You either recruited, transported, or harbored for the purpose of exploitation, and you had trafficking. Now, the United Nations loves these types of definitions, and for 6 years I supported it. But if you would ask me, I would just eliminate this definition completely for a couple of reasons. Number one, it puts all kinds of emphasis on the movement of a person into something bad without emphasizing the bad thing itself. It's almost like everything leading up to a rape is the problem, but not the rape itself. Everything leading up to the enslavement is the problem, but not the slavery itself. So if we take that away, what do we call it? Well, we're calling it slavery now. Why? Because if a person doesn't get paid, if the person can't leave the situation, if there's debts and threats and physical violence and all of these other things there, what else do you call it? And even after all these years, I've said human trafficking probably a million times in presentations and speeches, it resonates no emotion. Slavery does. The word war does. The word abortion does. So in English, slavery comes closest to what it is that we're talking about related to this particular issue. And what we're seeing is in the paradigm of forced labor and the outcome of human trafficking, child labor, traditional slavery, they're all coming into the center and being called slavery. And this is only within the last 2 years that we're seeing this transition. And I suspect what will happen in about 3 years is you'll hardly see the terminology of human trafficking. It'll be replaced by slavery type of terminology. Now, when I say that, a lot of people say, well, come on, Mr. Friedman or Matt, we don't have any slaves in the world. That was abolished years and years and years ago. In the United States, you had a war fought over it. Well, according to the Slavery Index, which just came out last year, this is the number of people that are identified to be in slavery conditions, close to 36 million people. And from this, you can see that it's in every part of the world. Of all the 80 countries that I visited, I've been able to find it in just about every country that I've gone to. It's just something that's there. Now, when we talk about slavery, it's not like the slavery of 150 years ago, where you had people going in with boats and putting shackles on and chains and cages. The shackles are in a person's mind. The person is told that if you don't do what I say, something bad will happen to you or to somebody else. And often that is what holds them in place in that situation. So it's a different way of basically holding people in place. Here in Asia, about 23 million people, or around 66% of the overall number. And the reason for that is, well, Asia has a lot of people. And secondly, there's remnants of feudal systems that have been in place for many, many, many years here that have never been completely eliminated. To put that number into perspective, it's approximately the population size of Canada, or if you were to take the smallest 100 countries in the world, it would add up to something less than 35 million or 36 million people. When you look at the top 10 countries in the world, India being the first, China second, you see that out of the 10, six of them are Asian countries. And if you add up those numbers, it comes out to around 69% of the cases around the world. And you'll understand the importance of this number a little bit later. Percentage of the overall population looks at, for every 100 people, how many people are slaves? And the winners in this particular case of Mauritania and Uzbekistan. And then you see some of the other countries there. India is quite concerning simply because India has such a large population. If one out of 100 people are slaves, then you're really talking about a lot of people in slavery-like circumstances. If you break down the figures from children and adults, it's about 25% children, 75% adults, with gender ratio would be 55 women and girls, 45 men and boys. Forced labor and forced prostitution, when most people think about human trafficking, they think it's forced prostitution from countries like Nepal to India. But for the most part, the lion's share of the slavery actually falls into forced labor. And when you stop and look at that number, 60% of that number is associated with supply chains or the goods that we buy every day. So as consumers, whether we like it or not, we are contributing to human slavery by being consumers. We don't know whether or not the phone or the food or the clothes we have aren't tainted by something down the line, and I'm sure all of us at different points in our lives have supported slavery as a result of that. Now, when it comes to the responses that are often, there are three categories. The first category is prevention, and that's basically just preventing people from getting into slavery-type circumstances. And I'll tell you one story related to this, and it relates to Mongolia. So in Mongolia, we knew that girls were being trafficked from Mongolia to Japan and then ending up in the brothels in Macau in forced prostitution. There would be an ad in the back of the newspaper. The ad would say, if you're between the ages of 17 and 21, if you're beautiful, if you are unmarried and you want to make a bunch of money, call us and we'll send you off to Japan to work in a restaurant. So they would call. They'd eventually end up in a restaurant. For 2 weeks later, they would be sent to Macau. They'd be tricked and forced into a situation where they provided sexual services, and then 2 years later, they'd end up going back home but not telling anyone because of the shame associated with that. We knew this was happening, so what did we do? We bought a cell phone, we put a bunch of minutes on it, we hired an NGO person, we trained her to answer the phone, and then we put an ad in the paper next to all the other ads that said, before you contact anyone else, contact us first. So the girls would call up and say, do you got a job? I'd say, no, but guess what? We're going to tell you about all these other jobs. So it helped to prevent them from making a bad mistake. Second group of people that started to call were people who had been trafficked, who didn't know Noella, who didn't know who to talk to. They started calling up and telling us what their cases were. We went from 3 reported cases to over 200 as a result of that. And the third group of people that started to call were the traffickers. They said, who are you? Where are you? We're going to come and get you. We're going to kill you. And because it was a cell phone, we had their number. We could track them down and go after them. This is an example of a good prevention program. The second category is legal responses, and this is basically because human trafficking is a crime, or rather it's a series of crimes that are tied together to almost in a syndromic package. Unlike rape and robbery and murder where you have one crime, human trafficking is about 50 different little crimes that come together and we call it human trafficking. And as a result of the fact that it's so many of these crimes, it's often confusing to law enforcement. Is it smuggling? Is it trafficking? Is it exploitation? What's that line that you have to cross over? So as a result of that, we don't really move a lot of those cases forward, and you'll understand that a little bit later. The important part of this prosecution step, though, when it comes to laws, is making sure that the law that is put in place to address human slavery protects the victim. So if she's forced into prostitution, and prostitution is against the law in a country, and the police come in and arrest her, if she's a victim of human trafficking, the law is supposed to say you get a get-out-of-jail-free card and somebody's going to help you afterwards. The last category is protection. This is where the victims are basically brought to shelters, given support, given psychosocial care, health care, and eventually brought home and then given other services over time. The best combination of services addresses the person's needs from the point at which she's out of the harmful environment to a stable situation after that. Now, I had a girl come to me and say that she was raped 1,142 times. And that was a very specific number. And I said to her, excuse me? She says, yes, 1,142 times. Every time I was forced to have sex, I considered it rape. That's how many times I was raped. I asked her why she counted. She said, because I'm a woman, and if I was raped once or twice or 3 times, I would know. I was raped 1,142 times. I tell that story because people who enter into these shelters are broken. They have no confidence. They have no self-esteem. They have nothing going for them. Many of them want to commit suicide. They carry so much shame. So the support systems that happen afterwards are an essential part of helping them to get on with their life. When it comes to organizations that are supposed to help, well, it's supposed to be the governments, but most governments really don't like this topic. It's embarrassing to have slavery inside your country. So whether it's the United States or the UK or Hong Kong or China or Thailand, everyone pretty much doesn't like this topic. I worked for the United Nations for a long time, and with all due respect to the United Nations, they just never get close enough to the action to really be able to make much of a difference. The group that's really making a difference are the NGOs. They're the ones that do the prevention, prosecution, protection. They do the heavy lifting. But when we go back to the numbers, and if out of 36 million people, 75% of them are in forced labor situations, and 60% are associated with supply chains, then there's another group that has to be involved, and that's the private sector. Now, up until now, the private sector has seen this as a threat. Most people who engage them with this issue engage by saying, you're doing something wrong, and we're going to tell the world what you're doing wrong. And so a lot of them do everything they can to stay away from it. Unless consumers get interested in this topic, the private sector isn't really necessarily going to move forward on this. But we're beginning to see changes over time. Now, just a couple of points about changes in the last 10 years related to the trends. Forced labor 10 years ago, that's all we did, forced prostitution with human trafficking. In the last 3 or 4 years, forced labor has started to come into the picture. Much of the emphasis in the past was on governments, UN, and NGOs, and now we're seeing the private sector being brought in with discussions of supply chains being the entry point. When it came to funding for these programs, it was usually governments, traditional foundations that were funding this. Now we're seeing high net worth people, billionaires that are stepping up and saying, I think that this is a problem that I want to put my money next to. Small scale independent NGO projects are being replaced by big country programs. So again, if you have 69% of the people in the 10 largest countries in the world when it comes to this issue, you want to invest in those countries. And lastly, investigative stories on forced prostitution is what we used to hear 10 years ago, and now there's almost a doubling of investigative journalism related to this every year, and we're seeing forced labor in a lot of that. So everything up until now that I've talked to you about basically focuses on what the problem is and what we're doing to address it. Now I'm going to give you a sense of what we collectively as a world were able to achieve last year. And this is it here. Out of 36 million people, we helped 48,000. That's 0.04%. The number of criminals out of about 500,000 that we helped was about 4,000, or 0.8%. Now, if you look at that, you might wonder, is something wrong with those numbers? Well, not really. That's what the numbers are. You know, might also wonder, well, does the counter-trafficking world not care? Are they not working hard enough? Are we doing the wrong things? That's really not what the issue is. This is the issue here. The amount of profits generated from human slavery are estimated to be $150 billion US a year. I think the biggest, most wealthy company last year made something like $50 billion profit. So you're talking about a tremendous amount of money that's generated. The amount of money that's used globally to address it is about $350 million, or 0.23% of $150 billion. In the United States, we eat $6 billion worth of potato chips. It takes 21 days of potato chip eating to come up with the amount of money that's used globally to help fight human slavery. So that's like having a slingshot and going after a tank. You can see the difficulties that we face with this. Secondly, a lot of people just don't even know about the issue. How many of you in this room knew there were 36 million people in slavery before this talk? Okay, that's more than what I usually get. I usually get one hand. And out of a 500-person audience that I did last week, I got one hand. If you don't know about a problem, you can't care about a problem. And I think part of the reason why human trafficking has been such an issue is the terminology of trafficking was so technical and so confusing that people didn't realize that at the end of the day, it was just basic, good old-fashioned slavery. Many people don't believe that slavery exists. I was in Singapore not too long ago, and I had somebody heckle me the whole time, saying, oh, you do-gooder types, you keep coming up with these numbers and you exaggerate them. He did that through the entire thing, and eventually I just, you know, said, thank you very much. Let's talk afterwards. Went up to him, and I gave him some websites and gave him some referrals, and 2 weeks later he came back and apologized. But there's a lot of information that's out there now. It's well documented. We know that there are a lot of people in this situation. And lastly, a lot of people just can't handle it. It's too painful. You know, when they hear about all this rape that's taking place, it's just so sad, you know, it makes me depressed. Well, imagine if you were the person on the receiving end of that. And that's what we're trying to do when we do these talks, is to help people to understand that you gotta face up to these things, you gotta pony up and just allow for this to absorb inside of you before you can do something to help us to have it go away. And lastly, the complexity of the issue. It's not just about women and girls and forced prostitution across borders. It's in country, it's labor trafficking, it's domestic servitude, it's marriage trafficking. There's all different types of things. And with every characteristic you have the differences that you see in the respective countries and so forth. So you can see how it would be very difficult for us to be able to take on this very complex issue. Can we solve the problem? Well, after 25 years, I still think yes. Well, 36 million is a huge number. Compare it to 7.1 billion, and it's actually quite small. And the precedent for this is about 150 years ago, people had an opinion on what slavery was back then. About 97% of the people thought that slavery was bad, and 3% said it was good, and eventually the world changed that form of slavery. You know, why can't we have another movement like that now? So what do we have to do? Well, I mean, we have to educate, but it's not just about educating. It's inspiring and motivating. And I say that because there's a line. And on this side of the line is no information, information, understanding, beginning to think about an issue, caring about an issue, and then the biggest part of the problem is getting people over that line. What is it that it takes for every human being to do one thing related to this is a fundamental question. Not to drop their job and go down to Cambodia and work in a shelter, but to do one thing. And basically, if we had everyone just do one thing and we had millions of people doing one thing, perhaps we would be able to move this forward. Secondly, we do need the private sector to step up. If we have millions of people associated with supply chains, if many of them are visible so that you can find it, and I know this because I lived in Bangladesh for 5 years and I was able to find sweatshops on every street corner, and you could find name brands in some of those locations. Oftentimes the companies didn't know that was happening because it was subcontracted out, but business knows how to go after bad business. They have the human resources and the finance to do it, and if they were to use their leadership skills to be able to address this, we would be much further along in the process. Another thing that we don't have that a lot of other developmental sectors have is a global plan. So in the HIV/AIDS sector, all the way up to 30,000 feet, you have the grandiose plan that then goes down to the regional plan and then the national plan and then the district plan and the community plan, and everyone knows where they fit in. And human trafficking, it's been haphazard, and we've never really stopped to put this plan into place to say, what do we need to do to collectively reduce 36 million people from being in slavery? And lastly, we need to have some wins. We need to go into the big countries, work with those governments, and get it from 36 down to 32 or to 29. Now, in Cambodia, we've been able to reduce child sex trafficking significantly. The difficulty we have, though, is in those locations, when we tell the NGOs that we're going to tell the world that we're having an impact, they say, don't do that. We say, why not? They said, well, we need the money to keep coming in. And the moment you say it's getting better, then nobody wants to fund it. So you see the difficulty that we have is, on the one hand, you want to get the point across. On the other hand, you know, if it looks as if by it's getting better, it's going to go down, what do you do with that? So the organization I work with is called the Mekong Club. What a weird name for an organization that deals with human trafficking. Well, you know in advertising that when you have a company name, it's supposed to tell you what it does. And we intentionally came up with a name that has no meaning at all. Mekong for the Mekong River Club, group of people coming together. Because the people who are part of the Mekong Club are from private businesses, they didn't want this to be perceived as an anti-this or human rights that. They wanted it to be neutral. So we have organization representatives from Ernst & Young and Edelman's and Pitney Bowes and Kodak and Winston Strawn, and individuals who, when they heard about this, stood up and said, well, the private sector could probably do a pretty good job of addressing this. Why don't we bring the private sector in? So what we do is a lot of these types of presentations. We train companies, we educate them, we give them information on how to look at their supply chain. When they get into trouble, we help them. We're in the process of setting up an association now, where companies will come forward and incorporate with us to use their resources and their skills to have a place at the table. Now, why do they have to do it this way? Because they don't want to do bilateral activities with the world on this. They want it to be pooled, again, because of the sensitivity of this particular topic. They want it to be a safe space where they can sit down, talk about this, and come up with ideas. One of the things that we did, just to show the spirit of the private sector is Google gave us some money to do an app. And they said to us, find out how technology can be used in order to address part of the human trafficking issue. So we went to law enforcement in Thailand and said, what's your biggest problem? And they said, well, we come in contact with potential victims, but we don't know how to engage them. So the way the app works is it simply has flags on the screen, and you urge the person to press the flag from where they come from, and then in their language, the video says, we're the authorities, we don't know whether there's a problem, we're going to ask you some questions. If the answer to the question is yes, press green, no, press red. Are you here against your will, yes or no? Are you in trouble, yes or no? Do you need help, yes or no? All you have to do is press green, and you know there's an issue. So they don't need to know what's being said, it doesn't matter. The moment you get into a complicated translation type unit, it gets very confusing. You want simple technology. So this is another example of how we are able to address the issue. Now, two more slides. I always end with this particular story. Many years ago when I was in Nepal, I desperately wanted to do something to help address this issue. I was thinking that I would try a couple of things. Finally, I came to the conclusion, well, maybe what I need to do is write a book. So as part of this project, I would go from shelter to interview the women and the girls to collect their stories. At one of the shelters that I went into, there was a girl named Gita. And every time I approached her, she would kind of cringe and move back and say, no, I don't want to talk to you. But as I interviewed everybody else, she sat and listened to everything that was being said. So finally, on the last day in her shelter, she came up and said, okay, well, you can have my story. I said, okay, sit down. She sat down on one side of the table, there were several of us on the other side of the table, and over a 3-hour period, she told the worst story I'd ever heard, of betrayal and torture and rape and torture and everything you could possibly imagine, times 10. Now for me, I had thought that I had heard everything. I hadn't. Didn't know what to say. Finally turned to her, feeling like I had to say something, and I said, wow, Gita, you must be so angry at those traffickers for what they did to you, expecting her to say yes. She didn't. She said, no, I'm angry at you and you and you. She pointed at us. She said, where were you? You know, I sat there every day knowing that everything around me was wrong. Everything around me was slavery. Everything around was inappropriate. Everyone knew it, but nobody came. She said she wasn't angry at the traffickers. They're just bad people being bad people. She said she was angry at the good people, society for not caring. She asked me, why are you sitting here now collecting this information? Why aren't you down there helping? It's a good question. And she asked me that question about 10 times, and I couldn't answer that question, and I still can't. You know, I'm an expert of 25 years, and I can't explain why all of these people languish in this situation. So, it comes down to what can we do? Well, I don't think that the 4,000 or 5,000 people around the world like me are gonna make a difference. Until we get the private sector involved and everybody to do at least something, we're really not gonna be able to make much of a difference. So I'm asking you here today, okay? I'm pleading to you to think about doing one thing in your life. I hope you do more, but at least try to do one thing. First thing you can do is very simple. Just inform other people. You came to this talk, let people know that this exists. Go on some websites, pass that information along. That's something. And if everyone did that, then there would be a lot more informed people. Use your comparative advantage. If you're a journalist, be a journalist and go out there and come up with the stories. If you're a banker, figure out how bankers can address the issue and so forth. Teachers, I presented to teachers yesterday. We're just experimenting with whatever we can do to get them involved, and we'll figure out what we can do with them. Volunteer, there's organizations here that need help, or what's interesting about the volunteering world now is you don't have to go to the office anymore because you can do it from your internet. You know, and so you can do it anywhere. I have a lot of volunteers that basically just collect information for us, and that's super helpful. Be a responsible consumer. Before you go online and buy your next big item, just see whether or not the company has a policy, and if they do, congratulate them. If they don't, ask them why and suggest that they do that. Suggestions from consumers really does make a difference over time. Raise money or donate to the cause. There are organizations who for $3 can allow for a young woman to stay in a shelter, and maybe the state will pay for 2 weeks and she needs another 2 weeks. So the right amount of money, even if it's small, to the right organization can make a big deal. or sponsor a talk. We do these talks all the time. Last year I presented to 20,000 people. Churches, faith-based groups, universities, fifth graders, corporations, Asian society, whatever. It really is important for us to be able to kind of get this information out. So with that, now I have this thing that's here. Quit. I will just say thank you very much, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Matt. That was a really sobering talk. It's time for a Q&A, so if anyone has a question, please raise your hand, and please identify yourself and the organization you're with. There's David Lawrence.
Associate member, mm-hmm. Is your talk available on the internet?
I have the Asia Society did a talk. It's a 45-minute version of this. It's more detailed than this. I have it available if anyone's interested in it. And we provide that for people who are interested in a little bit more detail. It's hard to get the amount of information I wanted to get in 20 minutes, and that offers 45 minutes.
Vodine England. There was a story, I think, in the South China Morning Post on Sunday or Monday, was it, about the role of Hong Kong Airport in
yes.
trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to know that it was intended as a lead story earlier in the day, and then some fascinating thing about tariffs on luxury goods in China came and sort of moved the story further down the mm-hmm. news list, which I think is an example of what you're talking about that people don't want to know. What do you know about the role of Hong Kong in some of these trafficking movements?
Well, I mean, that I presented to the Airport Authority people, had a presentation there. That presentation is obviously much different from this one. There were about 90 people who attended. Had conversations with people afterwards. I think the difficulty that a lot of people have who work in airports is they simply don't know what this issue is. And again, they're thinking about that random woman who goes from one country to another to be forced into prostitution, but they don't realize the number of people that are labor trafficking victims and so forth. The other difficulty is that the person who's being trafficked also doesn't know that they're a victim. So the thing about a human trafficking is that you often don't know you're a victim of anything until you get to the end point, because everything up until that point is a deceptive lie. So the person's thinking, oh, I'm going to something good, and so they don't self-present. Now, if more people knew that they were trafficking victims, perhaps that would be a little bit different. And I'll give you an interesting story. In Myanmar, this NGO set up this film, and it showed a person kind of going through their life and then being befriended by a trafficker, and then all of the arguments about you should go to Thailand with me and everything else. And then the film shows how they get on a bus and they're driving to the border, and then it shows what happens afterwards. Well, they show this on a bus that's going to the border. And so what happens is a certain percentage of the people who are there are in the process of having that happen to them, and they see it play out. And then they get off the bus and they run to the authorities and they get help. Most people in human trafficking either don't know that they're trafficking victims until they get there, and even when they become trafficking victims, they don't know that there's this whole paradigm of goodness around helping people. Or many migrants go back to their country and they lie about their experience because they're so embarrassed about what happened. So a big awareness creation aspect of this is to go into those communities and help them to understand it. And my favorite intervention are soap operas. You can do 13 hours of drama that shows how people get trafficked, how people are being protected. All the TV programs will pick it up for free. You can put it on a DVD. The people watch it over and over and over again. That's the kind of content that you need to be able to really help people to understand the complexity of this. Because if you're in a community and you see everybody and they come back and say, my experience was really good, but they're lying about it because they don't want to lose face, then they do it themselves. There has to be a counter argument for that. Long answer, sorry. Yes.
I'm Matt, Tara Joseph with Reuters. quick question about the companies around this, and I'm wondering if you can tell me how much money has been raised in Hong Kong and which companies are most active. And also on the other side of it, I noticed you had a picture of an iPhone up when you were talking about products. Are there specific products that we know are involved in these types of practices?
Yeah, the difficulty with that question is that, and let me give you another story. When I was working for the United Nations, I got a phone call from an organization that was doing activist type group, you know, campaign work. They said, do you have any dirt on the Marriott hotel chain? I said, excuse me? What do you mean? You know, anything that they're doing wrong, anything that you know about? And I said, no, I stay with them, like the hotel. Why, do you? They said, no, but they're so big that if we had something, we could make a point. So what often happens is the large companies are the ones that people go after. So when it comes to those types of lists, there's very little investigative journalism looking at everything. They just look at a certain organization, so that some companies disproportionately get emphasized as being companies that have issues. And so until you get to a point where everybody's treated fairly, it's almost unfair to boycott one, thinking that, well, if you boycott them, that you're doing something good, when in fact everyone else may be doing in the same situation. So our emphasis is usually on boycotts. Supporting companies, encouraging companies to do everything that's humanly possible related to due diligence that is going to demonstrate that they're at least trying to address this issue. When we eventually get to a point where everybody's judged the same way, then boycotts would be the way to go. But up until now, we don't have that. When it comes to companies that are stepping up and helping, BT, Ernst & Young, Winston & Strawn, BNY Mellon, you know, organizations that, for the most part, not as companies, but individuals within the companies have come forward and said, okay, well, we want to be a part of helping to address this type of issue. Two examples of companies, after doing all the presentations with Cathay Pacific, Cathay said, well, we want to go one step further. So we negotiated putting the film Not My Life on their airplane for 6 months. They had never done anything like that. And that was a big contribution. With British Telecom, they saw our app at a presentation similar to this, and the engineers came up and said, we can do better than that. So we went back and negotiated with them to do a contest among their engineers to see who could come up with the best IT solutions. And as a result of that, there were 7 submissions. There was first, second, and third place, and now they're piloting the top winner from that in Indonesia with IOM and us. So the most difficult part that I had early on with the companies was even getting them to meet with me, because the topic was so sensitive. And then after a while they would meet, and then after they accepted presentations, and now with the association, the companies themselves came and said, step it up a notch, give us a place where we can have a safe space to be able to address and talk about this issue, and if you do, we'll get more involved in this. But there has to be both the investigative journalism, but you also have to have a place for these organizations to go to if they want to know what needs to be done, and up until now there hasn't been much of this available.
So just a quick follow-up. You mentioned company policies. I mean, are those easy to find on a website? Companies that have specific particular policies?
There's about 700 companies' policies on listed on an organization called Know the Chain. It's out of California. Julia Armand is the person who helped to set that up. In addition to being an actress, she's also an activist in this. And she was the one who helped to set up some legislation in the United States. You will see more and more of that becoming available over time. And what that website does is it lists a company, and it says whether they have a policy or not. And then by pressing it, you go directly to their website to where the policy is. Now, some companies have one line. Ford Motor Company has 8 pages. And they do that because they recognize that pig iron from Brazil is an issue or a problem. And so they want to be able to address that. And so the more information you have, actually, the better. It's been my experience.
We have room for one last question. Oh, okay, Francis.
Francis Moriarty, freelance and board member. First of all, I want to say that your organization was very smart to choose the name that you did. Because as somebody who helps organize something here called the Human Rights Press Awards, when we go to potential donors, they're fine when we say press awards, but not when we say the words human rights. Mm-hmm. They just back off. How we get around that is something we somehow have to deal with. But for years now, we're going on to 20 years of work. We've been honoring journalists who do first quality work in the area of human rights. Many, many, many of those stories have had to do with forced labor, trafficking, forced prostitution, all the things that you've enumerated today. But here we are after 20 years, and we're still doing those stories, and we're still honoring the journalists. So the question I'm asking myself is, are we having any effect by all of this? What good are we doing by calling attention to these stories that really take energy and effort to try to reveal the facts of what's going on and honoring the journalists? Are we actually accomplishing anything by doing this?
Well, my wife is a journalist who got an award from you, Silvia Yu, TVB, a Pro Report. That award made a big difference to me and her. When it comes to the issues that I often have with journalists related to this topic is, and I won't mention the big network, but there's a big network that I was advising for a while, who had this tendency of just spending 75 or 80% of the story focusing on the terrible situations that people were in with no call to action or sense of hope at the end of it. And I think that's often what happens in the human trafficking sector. Despite the fact that there's a lot of bad news associated with it, there are lots of success stories, and there are things that can be done. But if those things aren't put forward, a couple of things happen. Number one, you get so depressed that you just close your mind to this, oh my gosh, I don't want to see another human trafficking thing. Or you assume it's something way far away, can't possibly get anywhere close to this. You know, that's somebody else's problem. Or that it has no relevance to you. A story that basically helps you at the end of the process to understand and accept responsibility for the fact that we live in this world and we should care about these people is what I think is very much needed. And you know, and this is my idealistic side basically talking, where I say, okay, you know, as a dad of two, if anyone were to do anything to my kids, I tell you, they'd have a real problem, okay, because of me being a father and them being children, and you have that love and that desire to protect and so forth. I don't understand why that protection doesn't extend beyond our circle of friends and family to the point where young girls, 15 years old, what do you say to a girl that's been raped 7,000 times? Whose responsibility is that? Really, is it the cops? Is it the NGOs? Who's responsible? It belongs to all of us. If it's happening, there's 4.5 million people in the world who are in this situation, we know that, and it's been going on for the last 100 years in the same way, and it hasn't changed, whose responsibility? So I think helping through these stories to get the point across that we as human beings have to care about human rights to the extent that we don't get just right up to the line, but we cross over to do something, is really an important story for us. And those are the ones that I would give awards to, simply because I feel like they're the ones that have the potential to make some kind of a difference.
Okay, thank you very much, man. Everyone give a thank you.